Well, hi there. I'm Jonathan Doyle. Welcome to the Being Catholic podcast. This is podcast, I guess, number two for the interview. Great to have you with us. It's been amazing to see thousands of people accessing the site at beingcatholic.com.au and listening to the podcast. And this week, we've got a very special guest, a lady that I've met and had the privilege of really observing her work. And her name is Marie-Thérèse Gibson, who's principal at a fantastic girls' school in Sydney. And I wanted to focus this week on her work and a little bit more of a focus on girls' education this week, but still a lot of great stuff in there for you. So I really hope you can share the podcast with a friend. Grab the link out of your internet browser and just send it to somebody. And the other big help would be is if you could click on the iTunes link and post a comment in iTunes. Every time you post a comment in iTunes for us, it pushes the podcast up the rankings so more people around the world can find it when they search for teaching podcasts, education or Catholic podcasts. So I'd love your help with that. So sit back, relax. I hope you've got this somewhere comfortable, and I'm going to publish some other notes here as well so that you can get some more insight into what Marie-Thérèse has to say. I'm Jonathan Doyle. This is the Being Catholic podcast. Sit back, relax, and enjoy. Welcome, everybody, to the Being Catholic Weekly podcast. I've got the great pleasure today of speaking with a wonderful principal, and this week we're going to take more of a focus on some areas of girls' education and education for young women. So I'm talking to Marie-Thérèse, who's headmaster at Tangara School in Sydney, and one of the things I'd like to do, hopefully, if she is happy, is we do a little survey in advance of the interview, and the people that we talk to have a chance to put down some thoughts. And I think that what Marie-Thérèse put down was really fantastic and gives us an insight into so much of what's good about Catholic education. So welcome aboard, and thanks for making time.
Thanks for having me speak to you, Jonathan.
Well, tell us a little bit about the glamorous day-to-day life of a Catholic school principal. So when you come in there each day, what's, for those of us looking from the outside, what really makes up most of your day?
Well, actually, the first thing I do when I come to school is I go to the chapel and I ask God to help me through the day, and I pray for the students and the teachers. So that's my first port of call. Then I come, check emails. I come in early and get a bit of exercise because I think that that's important for health of mind and body. And then the day starts. I have meetings with parents. I have my own tutees. We have a tutorial system here at Tangara, and I have a number of students that I see every 2 weeks one-on-one. And so I meet with them. I meet with teachers. I teach philosophy. So like that, I have a few runs on the board in terms of being in touch with the girls and things like that. But it's really a people's job, I think. Yes.
Now, when I read your interview beforehand, you're a little bit like myself in some ways, is that you had you'd marked out a career that you were never going to be involved with, and that career was education and teaching.
That's exactly right.
So tell us about that. How did that happen?
Well, look, I was in year 12. We were filling out whatever the forms were there for university, and there were people behind me saying they were doing teaching. I actually turned around and said, I will never be a teacher. I actually started off, I was going to be a concert pianist. I enrolled at the University of Sydney with a bachelor's degree in music and performance. And after 2 weeks, I thought, well, I don't know if I've got the temperament for this. I'd always been interested in politics and literature and history. So then I swapped. And then at the end of my degree, I thought, what? And I was very involved with the Students' Representative Council there and pro-life. And I was thinking, how am I really going to change the world? And I thought, well, if you don't have people in education with ideals, then how can you really help young people to grow up with ideals? So I actually made a decision then to go into education. And I haven't regretted it for a minute. Obviously, this is what I was meant to do with my life.
Absolutely. And it's if we pick up something you mentioned there, which is the sense that of changing the world, and which is an impulse at very much at the heart of Catholic education, but also we'd have to recognise that a huge impact in culture has been the kind of taking of the universities by, at best, a secular humanist ethos, and at worst, a kind of Darwinian, Nietzschean materialism. So I guess a lot of the listeners probably wouldn't have that understanding that that the kind of cultural project that was unleashed over the last half century very much targeted the universities and education in general. So where do you see the role of education now, I guess, in terms of reclaiming culture?
I think that we've got to work very hard. As you say, there's been a huge erosion there, and it's been going on for a long time. I think that what we need to do is, with a lot of optimism, we know that what the truth is, and I think Pope Benedict himself said that the truth attracts in itself. So I think that we have to keep getting it out there. We have to obviously really think about how we're going to do this in terms of the re-Christianization of the world. And, of course, we're looking at music and literature, everything. We know that we've got to really strive to present all that is good, true and beautiful to the children and to their parents, because if it's not happening at home, it's very hard for everything to change just with the school trying to do what it's doing. And I think we have to work well with others to do this, but we have to have very clear ideas ourselves about what we're doing and where we're going, and work with patience.
And I guess that's, you know, that's really coming to the heart of it, is that that whole postmodern project about, I guess, of relativism as such, is that our kids, probably less so in your school, but have the last couple of generations have emerged into a kind of vacuum of pure relativism. And I think, if I remember from studies of things like the values clarification movement, and if listeners haven't heard of that, values clarification was sort of the idea in the 60s that there was no kind of fixed you know, truth or moral values. You just helped kids to discover what was their internal truth. And the kind of the critique of that was that what that actually does is create a kind of confusion and anxiety. It's not a question of dogmatically indoctrinating, but let's talk a bit about that. The young women that come into your school, they're born at this moment in history. They're facing many pressures. What do you see as the key pressures they're facing?
I think a lot of it is to do with within their own families, and I keep coming back to this and I tell every father I see this: you are so important in the life of your daughter. I think that within their own families, sometimes parents are time poor, and I say to dad, you've got to make time for your children and you've got to make time for your girls, because we know, and the research is there, that girls get their self-confidence from their fathers. They're modelling their future husbands on their fathers. If the fathers aren't there for them, we're in big trouble. And we see this, and we're lucky that our parents come because they want to work with us, so we're able to help them foster those good relationships. So that's one thing, Jonathan, yes.
So let's talk about, you know, many schools, many teachers listening to this would have, you know, socioeconomic demographics where there is a great absence of fatherhood. What do you think Catholic schools, if anything, can do for young women in that area of you know, that kind of that father hunger, or if there's been major family breakdown? Is there anything Catholic schools can offer?
I think and this is then coming on to things of the faith. It's hard if children haven't had a good father figure, and we see this, that it's so often hard for them to relate to God as a father. But we have to keep helping them with that, you know, that they realise that God loves them no matter what. And that's really important, that they have a deep understanding of God, and that we help them foster that personal relationship with him. It's also important then, if there's no father in the household, that there's an uncle or there's a good friend, that there's somebody there who can be a father figure for that girl.
Reading your survey again, what do you most love about working with young women? You raised some great points in your survey, which you know, you mentioned here, you know, you said, I feel very strongly about the importance of women being true to themselves as women, not just for their own sakes, you know, women as gatekeepers of culture. What do you just love about working with young women? What's the best that you see in them? What sort of gets you out of bed every morning to want to be with them and work with them?
Look, I love people. I love God and I love people. I suppose I see God in all of them, you know, and I really love them. And I just see that they've got good hearts. They want to do good things. And I've never known a girl who, if you're really appealing to her and helping her, that she doesn't want to do good. So, look, I get out of bed because I just love being with them and just knowing that that there's an openness there, that they want to do good things with their lives. They all, you know, I mean, we're a normal school, so we have kids, you know, who are stretching their limbs and, you know, having their little rebellions. But if you're there working with them and working with the parents, and if you're affectionate with them, there's got to be a demand, but always that love and affection. One can't go wrong, you know, and if we're really praying for them, and sometimes, yeah, they might not want to have God in their lives at this moment, but if they're immersed in that, if they see that we are happy, we are cheerful, that we love them no matter what, then eventually I'm sure that they will, I know that they will turn to God and be happy.
What do you hope for young women? Like, if you could sort of wave a magic wand and when a girl leaves your school, what are the core attributes? What's her self-schema? What does she believe? What do you really hope for young women?
Look, I say this to them. I have two things. I always, at the end, you know, at the end of their schooling, we have a little talk. I give a little talk, and there are a couple of things I say. I say, look, girls, if you learn to live your lives facing God, you will always be free. You won't be just going, you know, by what the present current is or just pressures left, right and centre. If you live your life facing God, if you learn to deal with him and have him as your friend, you will have many friends. Your husband will be your best friend, all of those things. But I think to learn to live their lives facing God, I think, is at the core of our existence. We're going to meet him one day anyway, so we may as well meet him now, right? then the other thing I say, look, girls, the most important thing is the final roll call in heaven, okay? We better all be there, right? You know, if not, we've failed. And we're not into failure here. You know, we have all the grace of God. And what's important is that we all get there, that everybody in this class, and you better pray for me so that I get there too, right, but that we're all in heaven. Those are two key things that I think. And I think if those things are in place, then they will understand their own beauty, you know, how they're loved by God. I think if those things are in place, then we're certainly on the right track.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. You talk at the end there about recognizing their own beauty. I mean, over the many years that Karen and I have worked with young people, you know, eating disorders for our girls run at 1 in 6. I remember the guy who's in charge of eating disorders at Westmead Hospital, you know, was interviewed on radio, and he was asked, you know, this massive rise in eating disorders, what do you fundamentally put it down to? And if you think of all the things he could have said, such as, you know, exam pressure, family breakdown, he actually listed that the desire to be in relationship was driving this desire to control. To control eating and to control their bodies and this sense of perfection. And there seem to be so many pressures on young women through media and marketing, body image. You know, do you see or have you seen a growth in anxiety in young women, say, over the last 10 or 15 years? Is it obvious or, you know, what?
Yeah. It is obvious. And, you know, a couple of months ago I was sitting down with other heads of independent girls' schools, and one said, is this just in my school or are girls getting more and more anxious? And we all said, yes, they're getting more and more anxious. And it's something here, I think there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of, sometimes they just feel out of control, and then they think if they can control their eating, well, that's one thing that they're in control of, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that the whole thing of wanting to be loved, and the whole thing of image is just so important, because everybody wants to be loved and the girls want to be loved, right? Mm. And then it all gets so complex and complicated there, and that can lead to this tremendous anxiety. So we are working hard with the girls and with our parents here to try and settle them down with this, but it is a phenomena, and we've got to try and help them, you know, to have the confidence in themselves, you know, what else can I say?
No, I think you're spot on. And I think listening to you, at the core of it all, I mean, we don't want to say there's no need for practical systems. And, you know, in our business here, we've released a girls program that went into 400 schools addressing those issues. But, you know, at the base of it all, is there a fundamentally, you know, you think of St. Augustine saying, you know, you've made us for yourself, O God, and our hearts are restless until they rest. At this fundamental core is this question of identity, and it seems that for many young women, and for young men as well, but for young women for our purposes today, this sense of I'm not good enough, I'm not beautiful enough, I'm not funny enough, sexy enough, with a huge pressure on body. You know, is it possible that Catholic schools, if we were serious about faith formation, and you mentioned this earlier, if we could give them a deep grounded sense of worth, value and dignity in in God's eyes, that we'd shift some of this? Do you think that
I'm absolutely convinced. I'm absolutely convinced, because at the end of the day, nobody loves us more than God. Nobody is going to help us more than Him. And at the end of the day, we're not answerable to anybody. We're answerable to Him ultimately. And I think if they can learn to know that they are loved no matter what, that He loves them, that He will give them the strength, that He will provide the right husband, you know, if they're trying to do good things, that they not to worry. I think that it gives them that sense. I suppose the deep thing is that sense of divine filiation, you know, that they're daughters of God, and that nothing can take that away. And that's their core. That's what they've been created for.
So let's put you in the role of super consultant who's now going to fix all the problems of Catholic education across the country. I want you to picture with me a typical Catholic school somewhere in the country, resource poor, time poor, crowded curriculum, you know, difficult, you know, not a huge level maybe of staff formation. But let's imagine a teacher's listening to this and goes, right, Marie Therese, this is igniting me. I feel that you've got something here. What does an individual teacher do? What does a school do to just take some steps towards deepening a sense of faith in young women? What can a school do?
Well, a school has to start with every teacher and with the principal herself. We can't give what we don't have, and we have to be the first ones to live what we're speaking about. So I think as a principal, if I don't put God first, I personally go to Mass every day, I receive the Eucharist, I pray the Rosary, I go to confession every week. I tell the girls, look, girls, you go to confession whenever. I have to go every week, because if I don't, God help you and God help the school. You know, it's a bit like my early morning walk. God help you and God help the school. Yeah. It all comes together. But I don't think as educators, we have to walk the talk. And if we're not ourselves close to God, and I say this to the teachers, you need to talk to God about your students. You need to ask Him, what can I do to help this child? The tutors, we need to talk to God about our families. What do you want me to do to help this family? The Holy Spirit is alive, and He's trying. We have to listen to Him, and He will really help us. But we have to, first of all, ourselves walk the talk and be very close to God.
I think there's a great quote which is attributed to, you know, it's one of those great quotes that gets attributed to everybody. But the quote was, you know, if you set yourself on fire, people will come and watch you burn. But I liked your focus on reconciliation, and you know, my favourite story is a few years ago I went down a Saturday afternoon to go to confession at 5 p.m. and I was sitting there very prayerful, and the church was quiet, and there was a queue forming, and suddenly there was a tap on my shoulder, and I didn't turn around, but this voice said very quietly, excuse me, would you mind if I go first, because it looks like you're going to need a very long time. And I turned around. It was one of my best mates, and I hadn't recognised his voice. So, but look, this goes to the core, doesn't it? And it's the core of the work that I do in staff seminars. Is, you know, I'm doing a staff PD day in a few weeks, and the research tells us that less than 8% of our staff will have theological qualifications. And I remember when I first started teaching, I felt this. I felt, wow, you know, we're not praying as a staff. How can we sustain this ministry if we don't do that? So Karen and I were newly married, and we did these 120 invitations wrapped in little scrolls, and we put them in all the pigeonholes saying, look, we should pray together for, you know, for just 10 minutes once a week, pray for the principal, pray for the school. And we had 120 staff, and I got in there early the following week for the first one, and we had not a single soul. And I know perseverance is a big thing, but you know, it was quite devastating. But it was bigger than that. It was the awareness that schools can get so busy running around doing and just But so what's a little step a school could take? Let's just say you were talking with a principal, and what's something that a school could do just to begin the first steps of deepening staff faith formation?
Well, it comes back to one's own example and then giving opportunities. You know, we have a chaplain. We're so lucky we have a chaplain here every day, and he's given talks on the year of faith. He's, you know, he's available for everybody. He doesn't have any position in the school except that of pastoral care and obviously advice for the Department of Religion and things like that, but he's here for everybody. We are lucky we have people who aren't Catholic. We have people on staff who aren't Catholics, but what's lovely is to see that they go to the chapel. The chapel's for everybody, regardless of their faith. Look, I just say we have to, if I'd said to a principal, look, start with yourself and bit by bit, you know, with prayers and affection and encouragement, you will soon not be alone. And it's a capillary work, really. Try and get your parents on board. You know, we now have our chaplain meeting with all the new families so that they know who he is. But try to work closely with your parents. Look, Rome wasn't built in a day, you know.
No.
And we've just got to, bit by bit, I think it's important then to look at the religion program to see that what you're giving there is really nourishing, that it's sound doctrine, really in keeping with the beautiful teachings of the church. And at the same time, not just the intellectual formation, but we have to teach the children how to pray. To take them to the chapel, maybe, and we do this. We have exposition of the Blessed Sacrament every first Friday, and we take the children in there, and the teachers themselves will read little prayers, and then they'll pray, or they'll say something spontaneous, and then say to the children, "Now you say something to Jesus in your hearts. He's there listening to you." We have to actually teach them to do it, because if not, they don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, with a lot of it's the intellectual formation. It's getting them to use their hearts for God and for others. If they don't have that piety or those practices of the faith, little things of recognizing, well, our Lord's in the tabernacle, so how are you going to recognize him there? Then it doesn't come together. You know, as human beings, we need not just the intellectual knowledge, we need the tangible things too to live our faith. So I just think it's perseverance, and we can never forget the grace of God.
Absolutely. There's a real tension there, isn't there, between what we do and what God does. You know, but I guess Augustine, again, you know, famously said, grace builds on nature. If we're if we're making some effort, if we're just taking the first tiny step, then, you know, it's God's definitely there to do the rest. I liked what you said about teaching them how to pray, because I think we probably assume that, you know, if we stick them in a chapel and cross our fingers, that they're going to have a deep interior life. But
they could be thinking about what they're going to have for recess.
I can't imagine that. I've never sat in a church and ever thought about which team was playing on the weekend. But look.
Well, at least talk to God about it and ask that your team wins. I mean, we have to bring daily life into our prayer with
God. We do. And I've been banging on for years a little crusade about, in terms of prayer and formation for young people, is that, you know, the one thing that we, you know, my sense has been that a lot of people in youth ministry and in schools have tried to out-entertain the most entertained culture in history. So we're going to do, you know, liturgies that are so engaging that, you know, that they're going to change lives. And that's important that we do that. But what I've been saying is the one thing that these, you know, our young people can't get is silence.
Right.
And the ability to bring them into a chapel, to bring them into exposition or something else and teach them even the most basic concepts of contemplative prayer, or just to sit and be in silence. So, look, that's one direction forward. And I think the other thing I wanted to pick up with you was, you know, you mentioned before about the teachings of the church. And when I'm doing staff sessions, you know, there is often a sense of the church is anti-woman, the church is, you know, anti-women in so many ways, and people don't even know about documents like John Paul II's Mulieris Dignitatum. And do you have, I mean, any thoughts on your experience of what the church actually teaches about women, about the feminine genius, those concepts?
Well, thank God for the church is all I can say. Yeah. Where would we be as women? Yeah. I mean, Christ was a revolutionary, wasn't he, in his treatment of women, that he appeared to women before he appeared to men, and
yep.
And just how, you know, the what happened with the woman caught in adultery. I mean, he was and is the champion of women, and I've no doubt about that. And so when people come at me with this, I think a lot of it is ignorance. They just don't have a clue, and they're just, you know, repeating the mantras, you know, about things. But I think if you again go back to the documents, and we have to keep, and we have, and this is, we have to understand them ourselves, not commentary on the documents. Let's go back to the documents and try and get them across to the children, to the girls, and to the parents, coming to the parents again all the time. We can never forget them, because they're vital. Yeah. I think that they understand, and the way we live here, at least what we try to do in our school and in other schools, is to help them realize how much God loves them, and that we have a huge role in the life of the church. The role of the laity is huge. Yeah. And we can never forget this. And the family is the domestic church. I mean, if the role of the mother in the family there isn't lived properly, well, we're wiping out the church, right? Yeah, yeah. So we need the family to be doing what only family can do. And the role of the woman there, well, one could go on for years talking about this, but it's just so important there, and the passing of the faith on the children, with the children. We do know, however, and I heard the Cardinal say this some time ago, that when they're looking at things, that if the father's practicing the faith, there's more likelihood that they will continue to practice the faith than if it's just the mother practicing.
Yeah, that's a crucial point.
Really crucial.
Well, I spoke. I did a parent night two nights ago, and a guy came up to me, young guy, who's got 8 children, and he's younger than me, and he's got 5 boys and 3 girls. And the question he asked me was, he said, "Look, you know, how do you really ensure, what can you do that when your kids are growing up that they're, you know, they've still got a faith?" And this was really important to him. Yeah. And I'm about to do a little video on this that I'll put up on the site. But we talked about, you know, the quality of the marriage, and we talked about giving them, you know, demonstrating faith in the home and giving them great experiences, taking them to great cathedrals or different events. But then he sort of came to the same point as I did at the end, as you said, that kids need to see, ideally, that faith is important to the father. Now, that's not to denigrate the role of mothers, and it's not to be insensitive to the incredible work done by single parents. But ideally, absolutely, you know, especially I guess for our boys too, like if they see a man who is really serious about his faith and prayer, it almost gives them permission.
That's right.
You know, John Paul II famously said, "My father never had to be hard on me because he was so hard on himself." Mm-hmm. And you know, and often again, one of those stories that we're not sure who it's attributed to, but a very gifted Christian minister talked about walking past his father's room one night, and the door was open a crack, and he looked through the crack and just saw his father on his knees praying, and that image was burned into his consciousness for the rest of his life. So now some shameless self-focus here, as a parent of a incredibly wonderful 5-year-old daughter who just started kindy, and a mini cyclone of a daughter who's 2, as well as my little boy. Advise me, tell me as a parent, I mean this with genuine seriousness, what can I do for my daughters as a father and as a parent, as a spouse, to, you know, to bring about the best outcomes for them as young women and as young women of faith? What can I do practically?
Well, I think, Jonathan, your love and affection, your encouragement of them, because girls need a lot of encouragement. We just tend to lack confidence. Most girls do. We tend to think, you know, well, we're not good enough. But I think being close to them, having the time with them, telling them that they can do great things, you know, in little things, you know, and they're not all going to be prime ministers, but just telling them how worthwhile they are. Being there for them, sharing their little things, telling them they look nice, that they, all of those things, and praying for them, obviously, which you do, and I think that those things will really go a long way. You know, if they've got those fond memories of your presence, they will, you know, it will take them through life.
Well, thank you. I shared with parents the other night, you know, we've got a great tennis facility near where we live, and Olivia has noticed this, and she's like, you know, she's very active and quite gifted athletically, and she's like, I've talked about taking her to tennis, and I think it was Sunday just gone, and I'd had a huge week, a very busy Saturday, absolutely exhausted, and I'm sort of lying on the kitchen floor basically, and she's like, "Oh, Dad, you remember? You said we were going to play tennis?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Oh, I'm not sure if it was this weekend. Oh, yeah, it was.
Oh.
And I'm, you know, and it's bucketing down rain outside, but the tennis facility's undercover. And I put her in the car, I drive down to the sporting store, I buy her a smaller size racket. And, you know, here I am at Sunday afternoon with Aiden and Olivia, and just standing in this tennis place because I promised to do it. And
that's everything, you know. Yeah. It's everything for her. Look, honestly, that was great that you did it.
Well, it's a couple of things to finish was, you know, I talked to Andy last week about parent engagement, and for all those teachers, principals, educators listening to this, and it's just been amazing to see how many people are listening. What can schools do to start to do something in this incredibly important work of parent engagement? So on the practical level, a principal's listening to this, or a year coordinator, or a teacher, and they go, okay, yeah, we need to do more with parents. What do you think they can do to make their school more engaging and a place where parents want to come?
Look, I think that it's communication is absolutely key. And our school, obviously, the philosophy is personalised education. So we expect to see our parents, you know, coming into the school at least four times a year to meet with the tutors. This is not, you know, paradise here. We have our own battles. We're a slice of society. But we do tell parents we want you to engage. And every parent loves their child. They do love their children. If we can help them understand for the sake of their children, they need to engage with the school, to communicate, to work together with the school. But even though we're time poor, we have to think, well, how can we make this happen? That to me is absolutely crucial. And it can't go in the too hard basket, because it is hard, but we can do it. So trying to reach out and engage with those parents is just so important. And we have a system here. We're lucky that we have it there. The schools were built with this system of the tutoring system, so that every family is connected with a member of staff, right?
Yeah.
And each school, but the schools can bring their own things, you know. We've just got to try and reach out to everybody. At the end of the day, the parents are free, and we can't force them. But at least if we give them every opportunity and every encouragement, and for the sake of their children, whom they do love, they do love, then if we can help them to make that effort, it'll pay huge dividends in the lives of their children.
Fantastic. Well, look, an easy one to finish now. I'll just get you to fix all the problems in the world here. We want to talk a little bit about the new evangelization, and many, many listeners will be familiar with it. For those that aren't, John Paul II wrote a document called Ecclesia in Oceania, which was just talking about the church in the oceanic region. And famously, he talked about something called a new evangelization, which he said would be new in its methods, new in its ardor and its passion. And I guess that term has resonated for so many of us, because rather than this bunker mentality of the church is under threat and everything's going to, you know, and this assumption that secular humanism and materialism will triumph is not given. And before I throw you to the question, the last thing was to, you know, Archbishop Chaput, who many people would know, is a great straight shooter, and he just said simply this. He said, the only thing certain in history, the only thing certain in history is the eventual triumph of Christ. Everything else is up for grabs. Mm. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about, you know, rather than bunkering down, let's talk about the Catholic school in the new evangelization. Let's talk about education. What can schools do, teachers do, even parents do, in this evangelization of culture? Talk to us a little bit about what your thoughts on the new evangelization.
Well, culture encompasses everything. So what we can't do is have our faith just a Sunday faith, or just when we say a prayer. It's something that needs, I think, to be lived all the time. And I think if we can, well, St. Paul said this, whatever you do for the glory of God. If we can have this there helping, and I'm the first one that I have to have what I call a unity in my life, of whatever I do, if it's playing the piano or whatever, that I do it for the glory of God. And I think that what we need to see there is that what we're doing, we want, and that's, again, our families, our children, we want them to be the very best. You know, we want them to be their musicians. We want them as artists. We want them as hairdressers. But whatever they do, that they do well, and that they put God in the middle of that, you know, for the glory of God. So rather than us sort of being like sheep running behind, we've got to try and go to the forefront. And I think if we have the truth, we will bring others with us, right? So if we're trying to help our children to be their best and to do their best into whatever field they go. If they have their strong faith, they'll be like lanterns, they'll be like burning coals wherever they go. And then they will be able to stand up, and instead of, I'm just thinking of a young chap here whose mother died a couple of years ago, but she was on staff here, and he's in the world of acting, a lovely young fellow, and he really lives his faith. I'm getting him to come in to talk to our girls, right? He's good looking as well. So
it makes it easier.
You know, to talk about how he lives his faith in that world, you know, with television and things like that. But if they can do that, then that's how you transform the world from within, you know. We can transform the culture, and we need the whole thing to social media, which is just so important. If we can, it's the new Areopagus, really, if we can just be there and really give out those messages. But the children need to have the strength and support. They've got to have the idea. They've got to know what the truth is themselves to be able to do that. But I think that the world really is our oyster.
Yeah.
Because people aren't born to be bad, right? They get influenced, but everybody has a good heart. They're all looking for the truth. And sometimes it might take them a while to see it, but they've got to be actually shown the truth to be able to grasp it. So, look, I mean, I know I'm rambling, Jonathan, but
not at all.
I just think it's the most exciting times to be in, that God is going to give us the grace. We have to be tremendously optimistic, you know? Have that faith in God and in human nature that people want to be happy. They want the truth.
I don't know if you've noticed, if you listen to this later on, a word that you've used twice that I've noticed is optimism. And gosh, it's refreshing, isn't it? Because we have this bunker mentality at times, and so many people seem to think that, you know, that it's the end of the road for faith and aspects of the church. But no, I think you're right. I think it's a really exciting time.
Yeah.
So I wanted to finish with and thank you for that last answer. It was really great to hear that. And my final question for you would be: imagine that you know, it's years from now, and you've decided that you're going to step down from leadership role, and you're going to step right back, and it's your last day in education, and the last thing on your diary that day is a new teacher starting, and they're just out of teachers' college, and they're going to be trusted with the girls at your school, and you've got two things to say to them, two absolute gems that are central to you that you want them to remember more than anything else. What are the two things you'd want them to know?
Well, I would say God first, love God, do your best for him, and truly love and do your best for the girl, for the ones you're going to teach. It comes back to that, love of God and love of others. I can't think of anything more fundamental. And if that is really genuine and true, they'll be great professionals, they'll be great women, and they'll pass on what they have to the others. And I think that that's what life's about, really, at the end of the day. We're made for love. And in heaven, there'll be love forever.
Fantastic. Well, I thank you for that, and I'm really glad that you've agreed to move your entire school here to my city so my girls can attend. It's very exciting. Not easy to move an entire school, but I'm glad you're doing it. So, Marie-Thérèse, thank you so much for your time, and it's been great to listen to you, and thanks for your service of Catholic education. I look forward to speaking with you again really soon.
Thanks so much, Jonathan.
No worries. God bless.
Thank you.